Hello, everyone. This is Sarah Longwell. I am here with my good friend, Ben Wittes, and we are talking about The French Village.
I see what you did there with good friend.
If I say best friend, it's a whole thing.
Yeah, no, I'm totally down with that because as I told you the other day by text message, my birthday present to you this year, Sarah, is that I will never compete in public for your affection. Whew. And so this whole thing is going to be a one-sided battle. I'm just going to sit off on the side and smirk, and JVL can rile himself up into paroxysms of anxiety.
Yeah, he's taking it hard. But I'll tell you, I think that there's a world in which I might have enjoyed the idea of two men competing for my affection. Unfortunately, it doesn't really work with my whole deal. But so thanks. We're at our episode two. We got a lot of great feedback on episode one. We climbed the charts. We hit number 13. And I got to tell you, as a personal matter for me, beating the Real World Road Rules Challenge podcast was just a personal victory.
But I want to say that I am a little bit upset that something called Giggly Squad is beating us.
Well, that's my favorite podcast.
I don't know what it is. I don't like, but there's just something that I sort of think we're doing something serious here. And a podcast with the word giggle in the title should not be ahead of us on the charts. So everybody tell your friends about the podcast because we got to get ahead of Giggly Squad.
That's right. I would like to beat the Bridgerton podcast personally. But we're thrilled that it was such an immediate hit. And today we are going to talk about we did episodes one and two in the first podcast. We're going to do episodes three and four today. So I hope you guys are caught up. I know from a lot of the mail that I've been getting, people are racing ahead, which is fine. So Ben, just as a quick overarching take, how are you feeling about the show still? Are you more into it? What do you think?
Definitely more into it. I'm repenting my earlier episode one enthusiasm for keeping found babies after episode four, where the father of Tequiero shows up and is lied to in order that the mayor's wife can keep the baby. And then she and the cop engineer his arrest to get him out of the way so that they can keep the baby. And so we've gone from the question of what to do with lost babies in war to how actively should we use the oppressive power of authoritarian states in order to keep unwanted parents away from their biological offspring. So I feel quite repentant about having suggested that at least while the war is ongoing, hanging on to the baby whose parents, one of whom is dead and the other of whom is of unknown place, is not a bad thing to do. But I'm very taken up with the various plot lines in the show. And I'm kind of amazed at how many important historical threads the show is dealing with almost immediately and sort of simultaneously scene by scene. So I'm pretty hooked.
Okay, well, I'm so glad to hear it.
We only have five episodes to go. So
I know.
It would suck if I were like down on it.
Yeah, it'd be inconvenient for me if you were like, why did you make me watch the show? I hate this. Tough. So let's just, since you mentioned kind of the plot points, I'm just going to hit really quickly some of the top ones so we can jump into some of the deeper things. But in episode three, this is the episode that kind of frames up around a German line has been cut. You know, it's a phone line or a transmission line of some kind. And the Germans are upset. And so they go to Dr. Larcher, who is now the mayor, and they are saying, and this is one of these themes that when I rewatched it, I was like, okay, this is something that repeats itself throughout the show and is actually significant, is this idea of them telling him to make a list, right? He is to make a list of all the family men in the village, and he doesn't know why. But there is a tremendous amount of fear whenever you are asked to make a list and put people, your townspeople, on it for the Germans. But this is a thing that he is asked to do. It's not going to be the last time. So that's kind of the framing of one central plot point. Then the other one is Marcel, our communist, who is Dr. Larcher's brother, is asked to go to a secret meeting with the communist leader and has to sneak out to do it. The Germans have come to ask Schwartz, who owns the sawmill, to do work for them. They want him to build, help provide the wood to build a barracks. And then Lucien, our young school teacher who presided over the strafing of the children in the first episode, she is being sort of people are coming to hold her accountable for this, and she is sort of forced into signing a confession. So those are like the big things that are going on in this episode. What did you think about the whole setup of that they were pulling all of these men together, the family men, and sort of punishing them for the fact that the line had been cut by making them go catch the perpetrator?
Right. So this is, first of all, quite historically realistic. In German occupations all over Europe, particularly Western Europe, the Eastern European occupations, they were much more apt to just kill Slavs, whom they regarded as subhuman. But the idea that, you know, they would ask or demand people to designate what were effectively hostages, and would have sort of retributive executions against village people designated by the village sometimes, what they called reprisals, was a very typical thing that the German occupations did in a lot of these countries. The wrinkle here, so that this sets up very cleverly, because the mayor, Larcher, thinks that's what's happening, right? He's being asked to present names. And then, in fact, they're being drafted sort of into a kind of neighborhood watch to watch the, which is essentially a sleep deprivation technique, to watch the lines all night. And so it is a kind of harbinger of what, you know, the Germans are going to end up doing relatively quickly in occupied France. It actually takes you by surprise that that's not what's happening. But in their minds, it is what's happening anyway, because there's this constant sense of menace about it. They're essentially being conscripted into, it's a form of slave labor, right? They're being forced to watch. I suppose they do have pay for it in a very trivial sort of way, but they're being forced to watch, to do German military activity, at least on the defensive side. But of course, they are not armed, and the real point is to humiliate them. And then, of course, the plot twist to it is that the actual destruction of the telegraph line is in fact accidental by somebody who was just trying to steal a ham and was using the tele that line as a foothold for a way to get out of the school. And so the entire premise of both the Germans and the French villagers, which is that somebody is engaged in sabotage, turns out to be wrong. It's just somebody engaged in, you know, stealing a ham.
Yeah, that's right. And I think your point about humiliation is exactly right. And they know, the villagers understand this, that this is, that everything that is happening to them is about the Germans establishing who's in charge here. We are in charge here, and we can make you do these things. But you can see the villagers kind of, and this is in these early episodes, what I find, I think menacing was the word you used, is that these are people who don't know exactly where it's going. And so they are trying to figure out in real time how to handle each of these things. So, for example, Dr. Larcher, you learn something about him when he makes this first list because he puts himself on it. He puts himself on it, but he leaves his brother off of it. And so in doing those things, you know that he is both trying, he is both worried that it could be something very serious and therefore he won't put his brother on it, but he is willing to put himself on it and to go into it with everybody else, as well as the chief of police. And the, there's this, this moment when the German, I guess I don't know what his rank would be, but the commander who's overseeing all of this sees that Dr. Larcher has put himself on the list and is very startled by that idea, that the two men he's dealing with as his emissaries between the Germans and the town would put themselves on the list is like a shocking thing to him.
Well, and he's, I think, impressed by it. He, you know, this is where 19th century honor culture of a type that really does not survive World War II has little moments, right, where, you know, the mayor of the town, you know, understanding that you might be taking civilians, says, first me. And the German officer in that sort of Prussian honor culture tradition, I don't know if he is, he's from the Ruhr actually, so he's not Prussian, but it's the Prussian officer tradition, is, you know, stolidly impressed and sort of says, I didn't expect you to do that. But it's with a positive sheen. And actually, I wondered if the fact that they were not held hostage and threatened, if you don't catch this person, we're going to shoot these people, was in fact like whether it was originally meant that it was going to be as soft as neighborhood watch until we catch this guy, or whether there was a, well, we can't shoot our partner, the mayor, so he's kind of called our bluff, so we'll fall back on this neighborhood watch situation.
Yeah, that's a good question. The other thing that's interesting to me about this episode is like the ham, right? Because the ham and the fact that there was the person that you find out that the person was trying to climb into the school because they knew that the school pantry would have food. The ham finds its way to the mayor's table, and that's because you learn through this whole thing about the black market, which is something that is omnipresent and is interesting as you like live in this universe, is that there is a black market for food because you can't get food, especially things like hams and like meat, other places. This is one of the poor people stop having this stuff early, but there is a constant. A lot of the people that we're talking to are richer, the doctor, the owner of the sawmill. And so you can see there's a lot of little conversations about like the coffee, which they still have access to, and like that they still have meat. And when the meat shows up on the table, the Dr. Larcher and his wife like look at the maid, like shocked that this is coming to them in some way that is untoward, because they just are so used to it, I guess, still having access to it.
Yeah. And actually the coffee example is a really interesting one, because with the coffee, which I don't think shows up until episode four. I forget who congratulates the Larcher's wife on the coffee, and she explains that it's actually not coffee, it's made from barley. And so you see they go from sort of in episode three having coffee to episode four, which is a month or so later, having a coffee substitute that is novel enough that they're explaining it to one another. And I think that sort of picture of adaptation and also of privilege, right? That rather than simply understanding that you now do without it, they have servants who are like figuring out how to make coffee substitute out of barley is a very interesting social portrait.
Yeah. So I want to talk about Marcel's meeting with the communists. Because I think there's a really interesting exchange, right? So he's told through a channel that he's got to, you know, he's given a code and he needs to sneak out past the curfew to go meet with this leader of the Communist Party. And so he goes and he meets them. Guy doesn't really participate in the whole code thing and is late. But the thing that struck me, and I'm interested in what you think about this, is that Marcel, at some point, I can't remember what he says, but he expresses an independent thought of some kind or questions what he's being asked to do. And he is told in no uncertain terms that he is not allowed to question the party. And what's interesting to me is that Marcel is very clearly somebody who is willing to be counterculture to what's going on in France. And he's attracted to, you know, different ideas, but he is immediately falls back in line when told by a party leader that he is not allowed to question the party.
Yeah. So there are so many interesting things about that scene. That is, first of all, completely accurate. This is the height of Stalinism, pre-war Stalinism. Stalin has just, over the course of the 30s, finished essentially decimating the senior ranks of the Red Army. I mean, he killed the entire senior officer corps, which positions him rather badly for suddenly having to fight, you know, the Wehrmacht, which is only a few months off at this point. The degree of party discipline in the Communist Party was extreme, and it was always the closer you were to the actual Soviet Union, the more at the point of a gun it was. But there was always a very, very strong degree of sort of understanding that the party enforced its will by force, and you know, this was a no joke. And, you know, millions and millions of Ukrainians only a few years earlier had been starved to death, right, over forced collectivization. And so there's a, you know, it is easy in this period to forget how malevolent a force the Soviet Communist Party was, even in this period of time, but it really was. And the French Communist Party answered directly to Moscow. That is quite accurate. So I thought the really interesting thing about this scene is when Marcel is the subject that they're disagreeing about, which is Marcel's instinct that they should be resisting the German army. And he is told not to do that and that they don't have a problem with the Germans. The Germans are, mostly just workers like us. They have a problem with the Nazis. But that it is not, you know, time for the uprising, and that this is, between the capitalist powers, or the fascist, from their point of view, capitalism and fascism were hardly distinct, right? But between the Western non-communist powers, Germany and France, they don't have a dog in that fight. And this is a really interesting and, again, quite accurate account of where the party was at this point, because this is the period of the Nazi-Soviet Pact. And for those who don't remember this, right before World War II begins, in fact, days before, the Germans and the Nazis sign an agreement, sometimes called the Nazi-Soviet Pact, sometimes called the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, sometimes called the Hitler-Stalin Pact. And this basically carves up Poland, and it creates a temporary alliance between the Soviet Union and the Nazis that only breaks down when the Nazis invade Russia some months after this into 1941, June of 41. And so we're now in the fall of 40. And so when the Germans sweep over France, the Russians are, you know, they're supplying them all kinds of stuff. And so the Communist Party in France goes from radically anti-fascist in over the course of the 30s up through Munich in 38 to just kind of tolerant of almost anything that the Nazis were doing, because that was the posture of the Soviet Union. And so you see this in this little, and by the way, there is a raging debate to this day between Marxist historians in France and all other historians in France about when the party actually began resistance, and whether there was any organized communist resistance activity prior to the Soviet the opening of the Eastern Front in 41. And the communists have lost that debate. I mean, there really wasn't. The party stood down on Moscow's instructions against the Nazis. And so what you're seeing in that scene is this little portrait of that, where somebody who's been sort of suckled at the milk of anti-fascism and thinks of communism as the bulwark, so to speak, against fascism, you know, says, hey, shouldn't we be like fucking blowing these people up or doing something? And gets like dressed down by the party, which is in bed with the Nazis for a few more months, to the everlasting embarrassment of the party subsequently, both in France and elsewhere. And so this is the period in which, you know, when people forget this, but when the Germans invade Poland starting World War II in Europe, the Russians invade Poland from the other side, and they, you know, they carve up Poland. We think of it as the German invasion of Poland, but it's also the Russian invasion of Poland. And they go to predetermined lines, because that was what they agreed to do. The pact was like, we will, you know, carve up Poland and share it, and that lasted until the Germans, you know, invaded Russia itself.
Yeah. And it's a great example, I think, in the show of where you see the plot and these people's lives being driven by massive external forces that you never see.
Right.
Like, you only get the faintest reverberation of them in the things that cause our characters to make decisions. But you don't, they provide almost nothing of what is happening out in the world.
And the most amazing example of that, that's exactly right. And I think that's so that you can watch the show without knowing any of the history, right?
Yes.
But the most dramatic example of that in the show is the fact that the little town that the show is about, the village, is sitting on the demarcation line between Vichy France and occupied France. And so, you know, it's like they never discuss it. Here's where the occupied zone begins. Here's where it ends. they do have this, you know, people have to cross it in order to get home. They have to cross it in order to do business. And so this difference between occupied and unoccupied France is this ever-present feature of the show, and it's never discussed what the background to it is.
So there's this great scene, right, that really, I think, makes this point that I love, where, so one of the plot points here is that in episode three, Marie gets a telegram delivered by Schwartz that say that her husband has been killed in the war. Lorraine is his name. But by episode four, he shows back up. He shows up, he's alive, and he goes to Schwartz's sawmill, and he needs to get over this bridge. And this bridge is everything in this show. Like, this bridge, because it is the demarcation line, and so much takes place on the bridge. But he goes to Schwartz, and so Schwartz now has got to get him across the bridge. So Schwartz is on one side, Marie's
on his wife, who's Schwartz's mistress.
Who is? Yeah, that's right. That's the soapy part of this.
Yes.
But there's this amazing scene where, you know, Schwartz is, he owns the sawmill. He's buddies with everybody. He's the kind of guy who can help a man while he's sleeping with his wife. They tell a lie. To the German guard, right? So there's a German guard on one side that they have to lie to. And Schwartz says, I am taking this man. He works for me, and the commander needs me to do something with the wood. And so I've got to take this guy across. And it's a bone of contention, but ultimately he is allowed to pass. And then he drives 12 feet where he gets to the French side, and he leans out the window to the French guard and says, I've got a French soldier here who's deserted, and the French guard salutes him and says, "Welcome home, sir," and like kind of, you know, whatever. And it's just that 12 feet is planetary in the difference in their worlds, and that's what they're navigating.
Right, and you know, in some ways, that distinction was planetary in the sense of whether you're dealing with German soldiers or not on a day-to-day basis. In some ways, it was not planetary because, you know, occupied France, even unoccupied France, was ruled by Vichy, and they were, you know, a fascist collaborationist government. And so, you know, the question of like living in Vichy France was no bargain either, but the entities that you were dealing with were French authorities, not German soldiers, as a general matter.
That's right. That's right. So I want to talk just because this spans a little bit of season three or episode three and four, but specifically what's going on at the school with Lucienne and her boss, Mrs. Morhange, who is the head of the school. So these guys come and they basically like they like browbeat her into signing a confession, essentially, that it was her fault, taking responsibility, and her job's on the line. And it's funny because it seems sort of small beer compared to what's going on in the broader world. But for Lucienne, who is a very young woman, I'd say she's 22 years old, max, you know, her job is everything. And she's very sort of self-centered. But there's this moment where Morhange is in the room kind of trying to protect her from these men who are questioning her and just being a parental figure or, somebody who knows what they're doing. And the men sort of cavalierly ask Mrs. Morhange if she's Jewish. And it's just kind of thrown in there. And she says she's a little taken aback, but not. She says yes, because she's neither. She doesn't think that that's like a strange thing to admit to. There's no. But what did you have any reaction to that scene?
Yeah. So I misread that scene entirely. I thought that what it was setting up was their attempts to neutralize her in defense of the junior teacher, whose name I can't remember. By saying, watch it, Jew. Because this is a woman who's, you know, she's pretty blasé about it so far, but she is a Jew living under Nazi occupation. She is not in the free zone, you know, in the Vichy zone, which of course doesn't turn out to be any bargain either for Jews, but leave that aside for now. She's living in a town occupied by the Nazis. And so, you know, she's trying to help her protege defend herself against, and by the way, Lucienne should be accountable for, she takes kids on a field trip, you know, while the German army is rolling in and two of them or three of them get killed by a plane. I mean, Lucienne has some stuff to answer for, but this is, I thought what was going on was that this was a brushback pitch to Mrs. Morhange, you know, watch it, Jew. Don't stick your neck out. You know, there are Nazis outside. It turns out, of course, that that's not what's going on. What's actually going on, and let's do a little bit of Vichy history here. So the Vichy regime took very little time to begin passing anti-Semitic laws. And this incident in the show takes place in October of 1940, I believe. The first Jewish status laws in Vichy were promulgated under Pétain's signature on the 3rd of October, 1940. And as the show reflects, they kicked all the Jews out of the army. They forbid Jews from being in the press, members of journalists, and importantly for this purpose, the civil service, which includes the National Teaching Corps. And so this is, you know, they come here to investigate a strafing kids incident where a junior teacher does something genuinely irresponsible. And what they actually manage to do is identify the Jew, who then in episode 4 gets a letter dismissing her. And we all think it's going to be the letter dismissing Lucienne for, you know, getting her kids killed. But it's actually a letter dismissing Mrs. Morhange. And so this is, again, a real historical event. And what you're seeing here is a microcosm. The French Jewish community is one of the most integrated Jewish communities in Europe at this time. There is rampant anti-Semitism all through the 30s, gearing up all through the 30s. There is, you know, what was called across Europe the Jewish question is hotly debated in France all through this period. But it is also the case that, you know, French Jews since the all through the Third Republic were actually citizens of France. And people like Mrs. Morhange are able to be civil servants. And that ends abruptly under the Vichy regime in the beginning of what then starts to be the Holocaust in France.
Yeah, I mean, this is what strikes me about the way that people talk about it on the show is when she gets dismissed from her job, there are two reactions that are interesting that happen simultaneously. One is that people don't know that she's Jewish and or don't care. Like they either do or don't, but they like definitely don't care. They also don't react with a kind of, they are sorry for her.
Yeah, they're very sorry. They're not outraged.
But they are not outraged that this is happening. Like there is a fait accompli sort of sensibility about like, oh, this is a thing that's happening. But it is a real shame because Mrs. Morhange is lovely and I like her and I am, you know, and that is a temperament of the show that you see that is like, I don't know if it's below the surface because it's right there, but you sort of have to hone in on it to see that those are both happening at the same time because people are sympathetic and they don't want it to happen, but they are not lifting a finger about it. They are not hugely alarmed by it. It's like, oh yeah, well, they passed that law. But there's something, but I'll tell you what interested me more than other people's reaction was Morhanja's reaction, who she says something as she reads the letter and she's digesting the information. She says, I just didn't think. So there's this sense where like, she didn't think it was going to happen to her. She knows what's going on historically. Like, she knows what's happening to other people, but she didn't think they would come for her.
So this is a place where the American sensibility, I think, on issues of anti-Semitism really get in the way of understanding what the show is describing. So our American concept of anti-Semitism is, people have prejudices. Some people have prejudices against Jews. So there are, sometimes people spray paint things on synagogues or, desecrate. Sometimes people attack each Jews, or sometimes, they don't let Jews into country clubs, right? So this is a very American way to understand anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism in Europe is a giant, structural, centuries-old approach to organizing society. And it's much more like the way we think of sort of structural racism in the United States. And France, starting at the time of the advent of the Republic, is struggling with this, because in traditional France, Jews are not citizens. They're not like part of the society. They live there. They're tolerated for certain purposes. They're also violently repressed for certain purposes, but they're not citizens of France. And the advent of the Republic, one of the things that it did is actually, and this was called liberation, was made. And, when Hitler talks about the final solution to the Jewish question, the Jewish question is, can Jews be part of a European society, right? Should Jews be citizens of France? This is a genuinely contested question all through the 19th century. In France, it has this huge moment in 1897 because of the Dreyfus affair. And it is actively debated the entire period between the end of World War I and this period. And so, in some ways, France is the breakthrough country. This is the country that, Napoleon grants Jews citizenship. This is an amazing thing. But, and Jews are in the workforce, the state civil service workforce, and Morhanj is an example of that. But it is always contested. And so if you're a French villager, part of the politics you grow up with is, Mrs. Morhanj is a lovely person and we love her. But that's a separate question from the political question of should Jews be part of this? We have Jews. They're not really French. And if you look at the anti-Semitic writings of the period, the word Asiatic gets used about Jews. Their ancestors drove camels, that sort of thing. Things that we associate with, in American society, with sort of real anti-Arab sentiment. That exact vocabulary was routinely used about Jews. And so it's perfectly reasonable if you're a French villager in this period to have, boy, I'm sorry this happened to Mrs. Morhanj, but this is one of the political outcomes that they've always had a sense of. Maybe Jews don't belong in this society.
Yeah, and it's interesting that idea of French identity too comes up in other ways. And so in these two episodes, there's two instances in which Marchetti especially, talks about, well, they're not French, they are foreign, as a means for why they don't deserve kind of justice or the truth to be. So this is the case where it turns out that there is a janitor at the school of, for me, indeterminate
Czech or Polish, right?
Yeah, because he's speaking in the subtitles, he's speaking broken French to them. And they kind of...
His name is Marek.
Marek, that's right.
Which is a, I suppose, can be, can I would think of it as no, as probably Polish, but could be Czech as well.
And this is a similar situation where everybody seems to know and like Marek. He is in a sort of institution at the school. He's like the janitor. But he is, because he is a foreigner, when they are looking for somebody to pin the theft of the ham on, they do it on him, despite the fact that it becomes clear through his explanation, and he does lie to the police. He lies to the police about how he came to get this ham, right? Because it ends up on the doctor's table, so now they have to figure out who, you know, Marchetti is. This is an important plot point, actually. Marchetti is now, like, moving in with the Larches, with Hortense and Daniel Larche. And so he sees that this ham is there, and that's connected to the school, which is connected to the communication line that's been cut. So this is all kind of happening and coming together. But he says he found it in a bag, or I can't remember, but anyway, it turns out that's where it came from, right? That it had been dropped by, like, the real thief, but they need to pin it on somebody, and they don't have the real thief. And Marchetti says explicitly he's a foreigner. So,
and then Marchetti does it again in the fourth episode with the guy who's the father of the baby. And, you know, he cuts a deal with Larche's wife. I can make this problem go away for you. You know, a foreigner disappears into a camp. No one's gonna ask a lot of questions. And look, France in, you know, and Mark, I don't, my names are, you know, my French name is not good enough to say this for certain, but Marchetti, I think, is an Italian name. And so, you know, there are a lot of people in France now and in this period who have immigrant backgrounds. So the former president Sarkozy is a Hungarian name. Paris is full at this period of Eastern Europeans, and it's a giant commercial hub. And so it is not just Jews. It's also all kinds of Eastern Europeans who are in France, and their status is complicated. It's never as complicated as Jews' status, but it's a, you know, there's this, you know, the French were struggling with the ethnic purity thing too in this period of time.
Yeah, but we learn a couple things from this the baby incident.
Don't steal babies, people. The whole baby theft thing, just don't do it.
Well, so this is what's interesting, right? Is they hadn't, like, the fact that you originally made a judgment of this baby was better off with Dr. Larche and his wife over the, like, nuns who seem to want to take the baby.
Yes,
and
right. My first reaction was, okay, we have a choice. Give the baby to nuns so that in the middle of a war, they can try to find its parents, who are in a different country, by the way, because the baby is Spanish, or wait until after the war and maybe the kid ends up growing up with the Larches. That doesn't seem to me a tough one. When the parent shows up and said, hey, I hear you've got my baby, you know, that's a different question.
That's right. And so Larche, Doc Daniel, right, who is the doctor who we have seen as a very humanitarian person, who we are starting to see as a moral person, who when things are in his hands, we feel comfortable they are going to be dealt with justly. The father comes to him first, and Larche not only lies to him, he then lies to his wife about who was at the door and just says it was a pest. And you can see that he doesn't want to admit to this. But of course, Daniel being Daniel, ultimately, he says he realizes this is untenable. He cannot live with himself if they just keep this baby while his real parent is out there. But Hortense and Marchetti have no such qualms. Hortense has one thing, which is she is very much, it's what she wants, right? And what she wants is to keep this baby. She loves this baby. And Marchetti, who tells Hortense, who's very clear that she feels like in him offering to make this problem go away, that there is a deal in the offing, that he wants something from her. He assures her he does not. But I think we as the viewer can tell that that is not the case.
Yeah, I think, you know, this would be what Trump would call leverage. and I want to note that this is the first time that the name Donald Trump has been spoken on this show. But, you know, Marchetti assures her that there is no ulterior motive here. And maybe at this point there isn't. But he's got something on her now. And, you know, you kind of know in that way that we all know how plots work, that she has not heard the end of the stealing babies issue, and that at least one person in the world, who, by the way, is a cop, knows her secret.
That's right. And I would say that it's also clear to us, just as people who view things or as human beings, that Marchetti seems to like her. You know, he seems to find her, and she is throughout the show a not
45-year-old redhead.
Yeah, I mean, she's not a bad looking lady,
right?
And sought after, I think, on the show. But so we learn here three things. Daniel ultimately comes around to do the right thing, but was conflicted about it. Marchetti uses the information as leverage and could care less about who the dad is because he's a foreigner and who cares. And that Hortense is like adroit at navigating, like she understands the social, she understands the leverage piece. She's aware of it. She calls it out. But she is also fine going along with it. She is looking for her answer. And that when Daniel comes back, she then lies to him about the fact that that the whole thing was a misunderstanding, a mistake. We can keep this baby. It's all great. And Marchetti now lives with them. So you can see how this is shaping up to be a complicated thing. But hey, I want to jump to the major plot point of episode 4, because I have some questions about it. So
British parachutist?
So they keep calling him English. And so this a parachute, you see it's coming down, and there's this through the whole two episodes, there's a guy of like indeterminate, like a soldier. He's in the early episodes because he finds Marcel wandering around. This is a guy who we do not know if he is a good guy or a bad guy. We don't know what he's doing there. He seems to have been a soldier. They keep panning to his tattoos.
Crazy.
He does. He seems off. But we're still not sure like what his deal is. He is taking a family of Jewish people to ostensibly help them cross, right? He's acting like a coyote of some kind. They get to some part in the journey and he asks for the money. They don't have all the money, and so he says no. And while they're bartering, he sees this parachute coming down, and he immediately cuts off the deal. And there's something about seeing the parachute.
And we never find out what happens to the Jewish families. At least
we do not.
At least not in this episode.
Not in this episode. But what is interesting to me, right? So he goes and he finds the soldier, cuts him down off of his parachute, and is deeply invested in helping him.
And the guy's been shot and is in bad, bad shape.
Bad, bad shape. So when they take him and he starts to help him. So then this guy goes to the road. And then holds up Schwartz and Marie, who are coming back from a rendezvous at gunpoint, gets them out of the car, takes them to the soldier, and, you know, is like, you have to help me help him. Number one, when that guy talks, the soldier, which he only says a few words the whole thing because he's badly injured. But when he talks, he sounds American to me, number one. Number two, I can never, ever ascertain the motive for why this guy wants to help this person so badly, why it's so important to him. Do you have any guesses on that?
I don't. It's always been My assumption is we're going to learn something about him and what his origin story is in future episodes, who he is and what his motivations are, and why he is invested in protecting this guy, but has no investment in beyond the financial investment, which he abandons in the family. I don't have any insight into. I was also a little confused by the accent of the injured parachutist, but he cannot be American.
Tell me why.
So the Americans are not yet in the war. The Americans don't enter the war until December of 41. So it's more than a year off. This is the period in which, you know, in your capacity as a daughter of a British person, this is the period where England stood alone, right? And you know, the French are knocked out of the war shockingly quickly. The British have evacuated a whole bunch of British troops from Dunkirk. The Battle of Britain is, you know, they're getting. I don't remember when the Battle of Britain starts, but this is the period when Britain is really on her own. The Soviets are not yet in the war. The Americans are not yet in the war. And you know, basically, the Germans have conquered all of Western Europe. And so there's there is an air war going on between the Luftwaffe and the British, the Royal Air Force. But any plane that would be flying a paratrooper over an English-speaking paratrooper, or even any paratrooper over occupied France here, is a British plane. And so I think we should assume this is a French show that has a limited sense of the difference between English accents and American accents in English.
So I know from watching the whole thing that that's not really true, that that's not quite true. But I just thought maybe you were going to tell me that there was, like, I don't know, some limited thing Americans could have been doing that would have made this.
Before even Lend-Lease. Like, this is before the U.S. is sort of quietly. I mean, this is really still early in the war, and you know, the British are the U.S. is neutral.
What about Canadian? Even Canadian?
Yes, I don't remember when Canada officially, but you could imagine Canadians serving in the Royal Air Force. I don't know that history at all. That's plausible, I suppose, but you'd have to ask somebody who knows Canadian World War II history about that, because I don't know anything about it.
Yeah, to me, it was both the accent, but also, like, it's kind of like a big, beefy guy. And because they have to carry him around because he's injured, you're, like, aware of how big he is. And so, like, I'm not saying you can't have big, beefy British people, but, like, every time you see them portrayed, like, this guy just looks more closer to an American, which Canadians would be.
Yeah, it's I don't know the answer on the Canadian side. I think he the best hypothesis that I could give you is that he's supposed to be British, the accent simply doesn't work.
Well, in any event, I remembered, as I watched it the second time, I remembered being confused about it the first time. I was again confused by it and couldn't quite place it. And I'm excited to watch the next couple episodes, because I'm not sure we get an answer to why this other guy, who I think, based on certain other conversations, is actually, and he makes an admission when he's left alone. He finally lets Marie go look for help.
That he killed his wife's
lover. And I think maybe his wife. He just says the screaming got to be too much, and then it's unclear what happened there. But there's a separate conversation happening between Marchetti, and we see this guy, I think he licking a marmalade wrapper at some point. So I think that this guy is and we also see that he's held in prison. He's in the jail at one point, and he is let go once they have Merrick. because they realize that that might actually be their guy. So, and they also
and
have
he's French, which he's Merrick French. Is not. And this is Merrick's another, not. You know, he's pretty clearly your ham thief. And he's also, they want to get him out of there because.
But I also think he's the escaped convict. Okay, so there's, because I think this guy is the French guy who's a little Looney Tunes, is the guy who is, who both the foreigners are taking the fall for. Because you hear Marchetti at some point have a conversation about an escaped convict from a truck about a month ago. And they say, oh, that guy wouldn't be around here anymore. And I think that he, so now he's telling us he's killed somebody. So I think he has escaped from prison. And that Lorraine, the Takiero's father is now taking the fall for him. That's who Marchetti says to Hortense, there's been an escaped convict. Like, they don't know who it is. It can be like that's
can
what
be
he'll
anybody.
Go to jail for a while. Could be anybody.
So I have a question for you about the paratrooper situation, which is you had said that Larcher is a moral figure. But his reaction to the paratrooper situation is not moral at all. His reaction is, I thought, quite amoral, which is Marie brings him sort of under false pretenses to give this guy medical aid, which, of course, turns out to be too little too late because the guy is gone and dead. But when the doctor realizes what's happening, he doesn't say, oh, this is important. It's we got to keep this quiet. He says, you know, why are you doing this? The war is over. And he has now, which is a really interesting thing, because, of course, to go back to the point we were discussing last week, they don't know that they're at the beginning of the occupation, right? They think they're at the end of the war, that they just fought a war, they lost, and the Germans are here for a little while. But he does not look at the British paratrooper and say, this guy's fighting on the same side of the war as we are. He looks at the British paratrooper and says, we don't have a dog in this fight anymore. And I think that's, like, first of all, super interesting, just as a reflection of the way people probably may have appreciated things at the time. But secondly, it's not moral. He doesn't look at it and say, hey, we're knocked out of the fight, but the British are still, you know, still carrying the flame. We got to help this guy. And so I was wondering how that squares with your, moral mayor thesis.
Yeah. Well, so, making the moral judgment, I guess, is something that should be left for much later, because I think that as we judge these people, ultimately you judge them in the aggregate of what you see them do throughout this entire period. I would say that generally when we look at Daniel, though, in the show, we look to him as somebody who is a decent person, who wants to do, who's constantly trying to do the right thing. And I think we trust that he is not a bad character, that he's not trying to hurt anyone. But there is this is one of the first times that you see Daniel's, hey, I don't want to be involved. Like, don't involve me. Like, he wants to, when he is told that there is a hurt person, his instinct is to go help the hurt person because he's a doctor and this is what drives him. He is a humanist. But when it's clear that he has been put in a perilous situation to do this that is political in any way, right? I mean, this is the difference between Daniel and his brother. His brother is hyper-political. Everything that his brother thinks about is through the lens of politics. And Daniel is the mirror opposite, where he wants nothing to do with politics. And there is a point, right? And I think this is one of the ways in which it reflects our current political culture, where trying to maintain neutrality at a moment of moral urgency becomes a problem, makes you not a good person, or can make you not a good person, when you just want to stay out of it. And I know lots of people in this moment or in the last few years who have wanted to say, hey, I'm just over here maintaining my principles and I'm going to adhere to that. That doesn't mean that I need to join potentially with a different political party to help beat back these forces that, yes, I acknowledge are horrible. But you know, the,
even if it means I might not get my judges.
That's right. And so Daniel's apolitical neutrality is an incredibly interesting thing throughout the show. And it is in that conversation you see some of the first elements of it. Hey, we're starting to get close to time, and I just want to throw a couple other things at you that are kind of observations. So one is, so this is obviously a television show that has a lot of soapy elements to it too, right? So there's there are a lot of affairs going on, people getting smitten with each other. But I wanted to say that one of the things that I liked about the show, as someone who doesn't love soapy shows myself, is that the things that in like a soap opera would be absurd, like a person presumed dead showing up alive, and would make you be like, I can't willingly suspend my disbelief for this. The context of the war makes the idea that like, taking a baby and wanting to keep it, you know, that Schwartz and Marie would be having an affair, that her husband who presumed dead shows up again. Those seem like totally believable. Now.
So the number of displaced people during World War II, it was literally in the tens of millions. And the number was so vast that there are, that, you know, people had no idea for years whether spouses, brothers, sisters, children were still alive or not. And there are still, you know, there are still like these mysteries sometimes still get unraveled in ways that are so the idea that in the chaotic weeks and months after the fall of France, somebody gets an erroneous telegram that her husband has been killed, that there's just nothing unbelievable about that. And by the way, you know, the baby stealing, that happened a lot. A lot of, for example, this is a different context, but a lot of Jews hid babies with Catholic families in Poland and in France. It was like this happened. And what happened when you did that, you know, you're maybe you survive the war, maybe you don't. But the kid who then a devout Catholic family does what you would do with any kid that is in your house, which is you have it baptized. And the kid survives the war. And then some relative years later, wants the kid. These cases happened a lot. So the idea that there's a baby stealing theme and a dead person who's not really dead theme, these are not implausible at all. And by the way, affairs in small towns, more the norm than the exception. Big towns too.
Yeah, well, we didn't get into Schwartz too much, but Schwartz is to the extent that Daniel is sort of, and we can talk about him more, but to the extent that Daniel is sort of like the apolitical, but also like doesn't want to get involved, then there's Schwartz, who seems sort of minorly conflicted about doing work for the Germans, but his wife is like, you will absolutely do this. You can see he is driven. This is a man driven by conquest in many ways, both business and carnal. His moral compass doesn't seem to be firmly locked.
Yeah, so I am a little bit troubled by the portrayal of Schwartz. And the reason is that there are some actual anti-Semitic stereotypes being traded in here. So if we assume for a moment that Schwartz is a relatively recently converted Jew, which is still my working hypothesis about him. Let us note that he is a petit bourgeois, or not that petit. He has a factory. He is lascivious. He will do business with anybody to make a buck. And he's not really very scrupulous. And you got some trading in some pretty, and by the way, he'll convert to Christianity to pass as if that's in fact what's happened. And so I actually find his character a little bit troubling. And by the way, he lusts after the married pure French girl, which is, of course, another, you know, the Jews, they're coming for your Aryan daughters thing. And so there's some like less than well thought out decisions, I think, about the way he is portrayed. But all of that is predicated on my theory that he is who I think he is, which we have to wait and see whether that's right.
We will have to wait and see. I think one thing we can agree on, though, is that Marie is not that happy when her husband shows up again.
No. And I got to say, he does not make a great case for himself.
He sure doesn't.
I wasn't too happy to see him either.
Okay, with that, we will wrap up our second episode of Le Podcast. Ben Wittes, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Have a great weekend.
Nous nous aimions bien tendrement. Homme t'aime tous les amants. Et puis un jour, tu m'as quitté. Depuis, je suis désespéré. Je te vois partout.